Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam, we'll be talking with Mike Weiser, a.k.a. Mike the Gun Guy, who is an author, a blogger, a firearm trainer, an NRA life member, and a PhD recipient, about the war over guns. Is there a middle ground?
I guess we'll find out a little bit, Christy, because I think there are middle grounds here that are hard to find. And this is a voice that's an interesting voice because he is a gun owner, but I think he criticizes the NRA a lot for some of their positions.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to talking with him and learning more about it. But first, we have lots of things to learn about. We're going to talk about research that matters. We have some information about just taking a walk a day and some benefits to disability.
About cynicism, and we'll find out if Christy and I are cynical and the risk of dementia.
About smokers and passive smokers and a link with hearing loss.
And about indoor tanning. Are there real risk even if you don't burn? And I think Christy, we're not going to have middle ground on some of these research that matters.
No, we're not. Okay, let's talk about we talk about exercise a lot. But this is research that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association looking at inactive adults, older adults ages 70 to 89 who are at risk of losing their mobility or their ability to walk on their own and to see what happened when they exercise.
Yeah, really simple study in some respects, Christy, because they took half the group and they said, you know, we want you to start walking 20 minutes a day, and the other half of the group just received kind of general information about healthy aging, and then they kind of looked to see after 2 years what happened to those in this walking group versus those who just got the information.
Again, after more than 2 years, the seniors in the walking group had an 18% lower risk of major mobility disability, meaning that they were more capable of walking without assistance for about a quarter mile than the group who didn't do exercise.
And, you know, you might even say, Christy, that this sort of research going forward would be unethical, because I probably would, because, you know, in the future, I mean, exercise
should tell people to exercise.
Yeah, and how can you not? And so the counseling here is straightforward, and starting an exercise program, perhaps with the role of a physical therapist, an exercise physiologist, with your provider, all of these are important, but boy, this is good news, and a simple walking a day can keep the disability at bay.
Good. Nice rhyme, Adam. Okay. Are you cynical? Wah, wah.
Well, I think all of us are cynical at some level to some extent here. But the question really is, are greater degrees of cynicism, and we should say what cynicism is, but are they linked to higher risk of dementia or disordered thinking as we age? And this is research that was in neurology.
So there have been previous studies that show that people who were cynical, and that is something that a word that encaptures a deep mistrust of others or sort of a chronic anger that can develop over time. People who were cynical are more likely to die earlier and have other poor health outcomes. And this one looks at a link with dementia.
And so almost 1,500 people who were in their 70s and looking at you know, those who had a test and showed that they were dementia, and then those who had a separate test and showed that they were cynical, were these two things related to each other? And it turns out it was over 2.5 times related to each other. So the more you had a cynical kind of feeling about things and those high scores, the worse times you developed dementia later on. Now, this doesn't show cause and effect, but it does show something that I kind of take to heart myself.
Yeah, and it's hard to know. Can you change your cynical thinking and then make a difference in your health? There are all kinds of questions that this raises, but there is a link.
Yeah, and I think that we do know that the more cynical you are, the more likely you do other things that aren't good for you, like smoking and not exercising. Mm-hmm. But in and of itself, boy, we want this to get out there, and we want less cynicism. That would be a better world.
We should sing our Don't Worry, Be Happy song. Okay, smokers, another one. Passive smokers and smokers are more likely to suffer hearing loss.
Yeah, this struck me, Christine, I'm sure you as well, which is that, you know, we see hearing loss, and I think concerts. I was at a concert recently of some group that was a cross between Jimi Hendrix, Santana, Dave Matthews, and a few other things that only my son had heard of, at least I thought. And it was so loud, and I thought, oh, I'm going to lose my hearing. But it turns out that a lot of the hearing isn't just related to that. There are other causal factors. Active smoking has been one of them, which I was surprised on. I did not know that association. And now this research is passive smoking or secondhand smoke could be a cause of hearing loss.
Yeah, this was research looking at about 165,000 UK adults in their ages 40 to 69 years of age. They took hearing tests between 2007 and 2010, and they gauged their risk for smoking or being ex-smokers. The interesting thing was that the current smokers and the passive smoker were more likely to have hearing loss than non-smokers, but there was some benefit for ex-smokers, had a slightly reduced risk of going deaf compared with people who currently smoke, suggesting that that you can help yourself by quitting smoking.
This was in the Journal of the Association for Research in Otolaryngology. Well, hearing today. And I do like this research, Christy, because it's another way that people can reduce active smoking and certainly reduce exposure to passive smoke, because getting older and losing your hearing, big problem.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about indoor tanning increasing skin cancer for the kind that can kill you, called melanoma.
And this was a study of 1,800 people, half who had melanoma and half who did not, and trying to focus in on those who had never had a sunburn, certainly from indoor tanning, to see if the risk of melanoma with indoor tanning was still high. So it's not just about the burning, but to associate that an accumulative exposure to indoor tanning might still be causing melanoma.
Yeah, they found out that risk was high even for people who never had any reported sunburns. So, I mean, I agree. We've known this, we've said this, but that indoor tanning is bad for your skin. It also helps to remind people that it makes you wrinkly and has other cosmetic effects, if that's what it takes to prevent you from doing it. But
right.
It does damage your skin. It's near and dear to me. My father died in his 40s from melanoma.
So this was in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute. Hopefully this and our other research that we've had a chance to talk about, and research that matters today, really can make a difference. But we're going to take a short break, Christy. And when we return, we're going to be talking with Mike Weiser about the war over guns. Is there a middle ground? You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking with Mike Weiser, a.k.a. Mike the Gun Guy, who's an author, blogger, firearm trainer, lifetime NRA member, and a PhD recipient, about the war over guns. Is there a middle ground?
We are so glad to have you with us, Mike the Gun Guy.
Thank you very much, Christy and Adam. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, in your latest book, we're going to talk about guns today, obviously, for our listeners. But you wrote a book that was released earlier this year talking about your first encounter with violence. And we wondered if you would share your story and what sparked your interest in guns.
Well, I think the two were somewhat different. My first encounter with violence actually was when I was a young boy and my older brother took me to see a photographic exhibit by a very famous photographer called Ouija, who specialized in taking photographs of very grim New York scenes, particularly at night. And the first photograph that I saw when I walked into the Museum of Modern Art was a photograph of a dead body lying in the middle of the Broadway with the cops all standing around. And it struck me, on the one hand, very scary. On the other hand, it was somehow, it just was something I had never seen. And it was something that made me think that there was a whole side of the world, that is to say, the violent side of the world, that I knew nothing about, and yet somehow I was interested in it. As far as guns themselves, as a kid, I was raised in the 50s, which meant I had three hobbies: toy guns, toy trains, toy soldiers.
Sounds like my son.
Right. But this was very typical in the 50s. And somehow the gun thing stayed with me because I was fascinated by the fact that these very small, very easily made items could really last with a minimum of maintenance for 100 years. And they do. I have pistols myself that I own that still operate the way they operated when they came out of the factory over 100 years ago. And in an age when everything that we buy, you know, collapses in about 3 years, the idea that you could have a consumer product that could last this long, and I think, by the way, that's one of the attractions that most gun owners feel. Many times they got guns handed down from father to son, part of the history of the family, part of the culture. It's not something that they're easily going to give up.
Well, I know that we're going to get into lots of different topics today, Mike. But one of them that immediately strikes us, and I think what struck Christy and I as interesting in talking with you, is I wouldn't call it contradictions, but things that are true simultaneously. So here you are a gun enthusiast and you're a gun owner and an NRA member, but yet I've read a lot of your writing on Huffington Post. You take a position that is perhaps not expected, and it illustrates that there could be a common ground. How do you come to a position where you can say, you know, it's not guns that it's not people killing people, you know, that they're guns that also are at play?
I started blogging, Adam, actually right around the time of Sandy Hook. And when I decided, what I noticed from the very beginning was that there seemed to be, particularly among the advocacy groups on both sides, a real dearth of, shall we say, paying attention to the facts. And that's not unusual with advocacy. I mean, you really want to promote a particular point of view. But it seemed to me, in this debate most of all, that there just seemed to be a willingness on the part of both gun control people as well as gun advocates, you know, pro-gun people, to just kind of ignore some very basic facts and just stick to their argument no matter what. And I'll give you one very simple example of this. The idea that the NRA throws out again and again and again that the Second Amendment gives people the right to walk around in the street with a gun, when in fact it does not, and when in fact the Heller decision specifically says that it does not cover that kind of a behavior. And yet, if you listen to the average NRA person or the average NRA spokesperson, you'll hear them saying, well, we have the right to defend ourselves, and therefore we can walk around with a gun. They do not have that right. So I thought from the very beginning, since there were enough people out there already writing about guns, that if I focused on trying to make sure that every time somebody gave an argument pro or con, that I just checked to make sure that their facts were correct, that at least it would give me a somewhat different niche. And it seems to have worked.
And so you own a gun. You're a life member for the NRA.
No, Christy, actually, I own many guns.
You have lots of guns. And, I mean, it would be an easy assumption that you would want everyone to have a gun and sell more guns and have everybody be behind
it. Actually, Christy, give you my bona fides in that respect. I actually do not believe that everyone should have a gun. I believe that there should be some very clear qualifying requirements for gun ownership. I think everybody who does own a gun should be able to make an argument for why they need it. I think, by the way, that the argument should be accepted easily and quickly without having to make people jump through a million hoops. I don't think that most people should be walking around with a gun in their pocket to defend themselves, because they won't defend themselves, and all they'll do is increase the level of violence. And if anything, I'm much more kind of a Europeanist in the sense that I do believe in access to guns, but I also believe in very clear and strict controls. To me, guns are a hobby. They're a sporting item. I don't think we need to invest in guns some kind of mythology that they're going to protect us against the coming wave of terrorism or anything else.
It's funny how you get so shaped by the elements that you were talking about, your childhood. And I was certainly shaped by mine. My father had a gun, kept it loaded. And when I was a child, maybe 8, 10, in that time, I knew he kept it under this one pillow. I would get this when my parents were gone. I would get the stool out and climb up and lift up the pillow, get out the gun, hold it, look at it. And then I'd be shaken, put it back and go away. And I had enough sense at 8 or 10 as a girl not to shoot it. But now as a parent, it that really has shaped me, that I don't want guns in my house because my son might not have that kind of wherewithal at age six to not do something harmful with himself. And so we just sort of stay away from them. But I wonder, as you've heard all these arguments on various sides of the aisle, how much people are shaped by that one little thing that's happened to them that just closes them
off. Christy, I think this is true not only of guns but of everything, but I can tell from your accent that you come from a part of the country in which most people own guns.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, one of the big issues about guns that people don't really understand is that there are two-thirds of all the guns that exist in this country are sitting in the 13 old Confederate states, the three border states, and the rural areas of five Midwestern states.
Hmm.
And when you get out of those areas, okay, guns are simply, they're not that prevalent. And people in non-gun states don't understand the value of guns or the importance of guns, and they don't tell the kind of story that you just told. But one very clear difference between you and your children. You, being at least in your mid-30s, did not, as a kid, grow up watching video games day and night in which basically all you saw was people getting shot. And the problem is that kids today do that. That's the diet of what they watch. And somehow what happens is they see all these guns going off. They see all these guns being shot, but it's not real. It's, nobody's getting really killed. It's a bunch of cartoon characters.
Mm-hmm.
So the kind of safety that you understood as a young child growing up with your daddy with the gun under the pillow is not something that young kids growing up today really understand. Because the countervailing thing that they see is bang, 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 and when it's over, just turn off the TV, and that's the end of it.
That is an interesting perspective.
We're talking with Mike Weiser, a.k.a. Mike the Gun Guy. And, Mike, I guess a question, and we're going to take a break after you give us an answer, but do we need to get towards a middle ground here? Do we need to relook at regulation and legislation on this issue in the United States? Because I think most people think that's where they dive into. And yet, I'm not so certain how easy it is to reach middle ground there.
I think the problem is much more complicated than that, Adam. And I don't, myself, I've written 135 commentaries on my own blog. I've written 30 or 40 for Huffington. I have never advocated a legislative solution to this problem because I don't think there really is one. From my point of view, what we're really talking about is a proactive way of finding out who might be at risk for being involved with gun violence. And the truth of the matter is that violence has been seen as a risk to health forever, and physicians and other caregivers and social workers know how to spot for violence with the people that they deal with. The problem is that most of them don't know how to go to the next point and say, okay, that person's at risk for violence. That person might be prone to violent behavior. What if that person has access to a gun?
Well,
that's the point at which things stop.
We want to continue on that line of this conversation, but we do need to have a short break. When we come back, we'll continue talking with our guest, Mike Weiser, a.k.a. Mike the Gun Guy, who is an author, blogger, firearm trainer, NRA Life member, and a PhD recipient about the war over guns. Is there a middle ground? We'll be right back with your health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Mike Weiser, author and blogger, lifetime NRA member, about the war over guns. Is there middle ground? And Mike, right before we left, you talked about how you think this is much too, I wouldn't say complicated for legislation, but that legislation is not the right or the best way to make necessarily a difference. And I guess I have a question because after the shootings at Sandy Hook and the shootings, all the shootings around the country, people seem to want to focus on that, and they certainly focus on a lot of anger and anger over the NRA, and then the NRA puts out lots of data that says it has nothing to do with any of this, and it's it, and all of a sudden everything just seems to blow up, and we get nowhere. So, is if we don't focus on legislation or things that we can agree on, how do we get there?
Look, let me tell you two sides to that. First of all, yes, legislation would have an impact, but it would be very indirect. And what I mean by that is as follows. The one thing we know for sure in terms of gun research is that any time you pass a law on guns, okay, gun sales go down, particularly when it's done at the state as opposed to the federal level. Don't ask me why, don't ask me how, but a certain proportion of the gun-owning population says, okay, I've had enough of it, I'm sick of it, I don't want to have to follow another law, that's the end of it. Now, to the extent that there is a link between rates of gun violence, you know, homicide and suicide and assault, and the number of guns floating around, yes, if you pass a law, any law that controls guns, you will over time see less guns, and therefore you will see less gun violence. But it's a very indirect connection. And that's the problem with this legislation, is it's not like, you know, all of a sudden we're going to say, okay, you want to save gasoline, instead of driving 70 miles an hour, you have to save 50. And so everybody drives at 50 miles an hour, and within a week, we're saving a lot of gasoline. That wouldn't happen with gun legislation. That's the real problem with it. On the other hand, I know that of the people who commit gun violence each year, and that's roughly 70,000 to 80,000 people, 10,000 homicides, 20,000 suicides, and another 40 to 50 intentional injuries. The people who pull the trigger, either at somebody else or at themselves, probably more than half of them saw a physician or other medical caregiver shortly before the event itself happened. Certainly that's true with all the suicides, and it's true with a large number of the homicides and assaults, because in many cases, these grow out of continued disputes between individuals, particularly on the domestic side. And these people, as victims of other kinds of violence, have been seen. So if you have 70 to 80,000 people, of whom every year half of them are seen by a social worker, a psychiatrist, a physician, an ER doctor, you know, a family doctor, before the, you know, they've already shown some evidence of violence, but the gun violence hasn't happened yesterday. If these people, these professionals, you know, were to say to them, hey, you know, are you, you know, thinking about going back and getting involved with that person again? Are you depressed? Are you thinking of suicide? And if the answer to those questions is yes, then it seems to me that the next obvious question is, do you have access to a gun? Because that's the only instrument that they can use that is so efficient and so deadly that if they do have access to it, the chance of elevating that violence to the next level is 100%.
And as you know, Adam recently published an article in the New England Journal of Medicine about this, the element of physicians' role in determining a patient's competency when it comes to concealed weapons permits. So we get these forms and we have to fill out so they can go get their gun. And it sounds like you do think physicians should have a role in this matter. And how, I guess the real link for me is wondering if the implication that has on the doctor-patient relationship, the elements of if we counsel them when they're, if they're sick enough or if they're fired up enough, no pun intended, are counseling going to make a difference?
Christy, I there's no universal solution, and there's no, you know, there's one, no shoe that fits all. But let me tell you something about counseling, okay? Increasingly, people seem to be acquiring guns or carrying guns or thinking about it out of fear. That's certainly true with concealed carry, okay? If Adam is counseling patients, if he has to certify someone's adequacy to get a concealed carry permit, okay, then chances are most of the people he's dealing with are getting that permit because they're afraid. They're afraid of crime. They're afraid of the unknown. They're afraid of something. Okay, the truth of the matter is that the only professional group in our entire society who counsel people about fears are physicians. You counsel people about their health fears, about their fears of dying, about the fears of an elderly parent getting senile. There is no other group in the United States to whom people regularly go to and will confess fears that they will not talk to with anybody else. Oops, did I get STD last week? You won't ask anybody that question unless it's the physician. So the idea that doctors, as a rule, would be somehow breaking, you know, this kind of compact with the patient by counseling about fears that might lead them to acquire or use a gun is absurd. I'm not saying you don't have to respect certain, you know, issues of confidentiality and HIPAA and all that other stuff. Of course not. What I am saying is that I don't see this kind of counseling as being very much different from the kind of counseling that physicians do all the time on all these other very personal issues with which, and here's the important point, your patients will not talk to anybody else about those things.
They don't always follow our counseling, though.
What? Oh, no, listen. You know something? If you're a pediatrician, okay, you have to, because you won't get paid if you don't do this, you have to talk to every patient that you have about obesity. Do they listen? I'm sorry, I'm not, you know, that to me is not the test for whether or not it should be done.
You know, I know the one other area that you've written about in a lot of your blogs recently that probably has not made you a lot of friends, particularly as a lifetime NRA member, is you've taken the NRA to task over a variety of issues. Help our audience understand why you're writing out, as a lifetime NRA member, things that take the NRA to task. What are you writing about and why?
Adam, what I'm really concerned about is the continued let me back up a little bit. You know, the NRA 20, 30, 40 years ago was basically an organization committed to training, firearms training. That's how they started, and that's what they did. And all of a sudden, about 20 years ago, they became an advocacy organization, not only just for gun rights, but in general to just kind of promote the whole notion of, you know, we should have a lot of guns around. And the moment you become an advocacy organization, all of a sudden the truth just begins to blur a little bit. My concern with the NRA is not that they exist, not that they don't promote, guns, but that I don't think that their membership deserves to be told things that simply aren't true. And the thing is that if I were not an NRA member, if I was seen as somebody from the other side, then the NRA would simply immediately dismiss me. Oh, well, he's just, you know, a gun control person and blah, 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 blah. But in a funny kind of way, even though a lot of NRA people are always calling me and writing me and telling me, you know, you need to shut up and go away, the truth of the matter is actually I do make something of a difference, because when all is said and done, they can't just say, well, this guy doesn't like guns.
What's one example of where you think the truth is not being told?
I think, for example, that the idea that if we all walk around with guns, that we will be safer and there will be less crime is simply not true. Look, we have had a 50% drop in violent crime in this country since 1994, over the last 20 years. At the same time, we've had an increase in concealed carry permits from 24 to 50 states. The NRA will tell you that the two are connected. Because everybody now has a concealed carry permit, the criminals don't know who's carrying guns, therefore they're committing less crime. There's only one problem. Not only are they a confusing coincidence with causality, but worse, even the coincidence doesn't work. Because, in fact, 95% of the decline in violent crime that started in 1994 ended by 2003. And over the last 10 years, the crime rates have been more or less stable, going up a little bit, going down a little bit, but they really haven't changed. In fact, the great increase in concealed carry started after 2003, actually beginning around 2004. So the tremendous decline in violent crime occurred before we had an expansion of concealed carry. Therefore, to tell people a concealed carry is a good thing because look how it's, you know, resulted in a decline of crime is simply not true.
Well, it takes a lot of courage and strength for you to to be able to be in the middle and sort of argue both sides and think rationally and not get too sucked in to the hype of one extreme or another. And we appreciate you taking this time to share some of your thoughts with us and hope that we can link some of your work and your blogs to our blog to get the word out.
I'm more than happy. My blogs are all, public. There's nothing proprietary about them. By all means, I'm more than happy to be linked. And certainly, Christy, if you put anything on your blog that I think is interesting to my readership, I'll be the first one to broadcast it all over the place.
Well, we've been talking with Mike Weiser, a.k.a. Mike the Gun Guy, who's an author, blogger, over war over guns. Is there a middle ground? And we want to thank you, Mike, for sharing your thoughts and views with your health listeners today.
My pleasure, Adam. And thank you both, Adam and Christy, for having me on.
Thank you.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
And if you have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, you can send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd ask to have our executive producer, Erica Lloyd, read us our very first House Call today. That has to do with nausea and vomiting and someone who's elderly and on some medications.
My mom is 85 and was throwing up recently. I took her to the ER and they told her that the beta blocker she was on was causing her slow heart rate and possibly nausea. She takes this medication for migraine headaches. How do we know this isn't just another one of her migraines?
That is an excellent, excellent question in a complicated situation. So, I mean, she could be nauseous, as you're suggesting, as part of her migraine, if that's one of her typical symptoms from the migraine. But she also, it's possible, the way they explained it, that she's nauseous because of the beta blocker medication. It's also possible that she has some other heart disease or a virus or some other thing that was making her feel nauseous. So it's very complicated and requires the doctors to put together a lot of different things and come up with their theory.
Right. It could be true, unrelated, true but not related, or not true but related. I mean, all of these things are possible. And I guess it somewhat depends on what do you think the story is. Mm-hmm. You know, the doctors have come up with one story, one narrative about what they think comes together. And unfortunately, we'll only know looking forward, perhaps, what was the right story here. So your viewpoints are important. We would encourage you to talk with your or her doctor in this case and see if they agree.
I think this is one of those reasons that the follow-up visit with the doctor after a person's gone to the hospital is so important, to put the pieces back together and in the context of what's happened since then and make sure you get that follow-up appointment.
Bingo, Christy.
Thanks.
Right on target.
Let's take our next House Call question.
My dad had a stroke last year, and he's now doing well. He's had high blood pressure for over 20 years, and his blood pressure is now 180 over 90. This seems too high, but I know Dr. Vieira was talking about different guidelines for the elderly. Should we be concerned?
Well, what you're talking about is we had Dr. Anthony Vieira on the show not too long ago, and he was talking about kind of these revised guidelines for blood pressure in the elderly, where for those elderly who have not had strokes, who have high blood pressure, as well as normal blood pressure, we might tolerate a slightly higher amount than we would in the past because we don't want to drop it too low because people get symptoms. But this doesn't really apply to your loved one.
Yeah, in this case, because your dad already had a stroke and because that blood pressure is so high, 180 over 90, we would agree with you that that does seem too high and would be worth going and talking with the doctor and getting him on the right medications to prevent another stroke.
Particularly that top number, that systolic blood pressure, we know that that's very important in reducing the chances of a second stroke in someone who's had a stroke. So your instincts are it's too high. Our belief is it's probably too high. Probably should talk with your doctor. Good question. We wish you luck and wish your father luck.
Let's take our next House Call question.
I've had stomach pain and am nauseous 10 minutes after eating for several weeks now. I'm taking Pepto-Bismol and Prilosec, but it doesn't seem to get any better. How do I know if someone needs to look down my stomach for ulcers?
Well, it depends if the doctor says they need to look down your stomach for ulcers. But I suspect that's not a good enough answer.
Well, the good news is that Prilosec and Pepto-Bismol will heal many ulcers. That Prilosec is powerful stuff to reduce the acid in your stomach and can help to improve that inflammation or ulcers in your stomach. You can get a blood test from your doctor without having to go through the whole look-see to see if you have the bacteria called H. pylori that can predispose you to ulcers. But sometimes if you're not getting better, you really just have to have them go down and look. What do you think, Adam?
Yeah, you know, sometimes when people eat food, it makes ulcers better. And those particular types of ulcers are the ulcers and we call duodenal ulcers. A lot of times people talk about peptic ulcer disease. Sometimes if the food makes it worse, that ulcer's in the stomach or a gastric ulcer. So I would also want to know, are you taking aspirin? Are you taking vitamin E? Are you taking glucosamine? Are you taking a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory? Are you taking anything that could upset your stomach? Because that's the gastric ulcer. And those sometimes need a different healing mechanism. So you might need to have someone take a look at it, but I'd try to get off anything that could be irritating at first.
And think about those basic lifestyle strategies of eating smaller, avoiding spicy foods, trying to pay attention to what kinds of things make it worse and avoid those if you can.
Yeah. Taking a look down there sounds scary, but sometimes that actually helps change what happens. So, you know, I wouldn't put it off if it needs to be. And also, maybe it's not related to an ulcer at all. Maybe this is a gallbladder problem here because the food making it worse. So we shouldn't assume it's an ulcer. Let's not make that assumption. Good luck.
Let's take our next one.
My physician is now using an electronic system to send me my lab results. I'm in my early 70s and don't own a computer. Would my children be able to access these records on my behalf?
Sure. I think there is a way that you can give the permission for your children and link your children up with your account. But that's something that you have to work through within the healthcare system where you are.
Yeah, I think this is also kind of up to you a little bit here. You know, if you really do want your children to have access to some of your information, that's your choice. It's kind of like giving your children access to bank information and passwords and logons. We wouldn't necessarily encourage that fully, but, you know, sometimes that could be helpful for you to have, you know, that. And, you know, I give my wife my information because if I can't get access to it, I do want her to have that information. So there could be some reasons why having that information available to your children. Maybe you don't really like looking on the computer very often, but you want to get your results. So I think it's also about your relationship with your children.
I think so. You can also ask your doctor, hey, and say, I don't have a computer. Would you mail me my results like you used to? And I bet your doctor would be willing to do that. So it's up to you. Thank you for sharing your questions today. I think we've touched on some things that are relevant around electronic medical records.
About stomach pain and nausea, and it could require looking down in the stomach, but it also may not even be ulcers.
About strokes and lowering blood pressure.
And certainly getting it lower than 180 over 90. And then finally about going to the emergency room and throwing up and being on medication, but maybe it's the story and which story that you believe and you believe with your doctor.
Thank you for writing in your questions today. And thanks to all of our listeners for joining us today for Your Health. We hope that we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you and to your health.
You know, Christy, we talked about an issue today. And we should just take one second here just to, you know, there's been a lot of people affected by gun violence, a lot of people around North Carolina and other states, around the country, around the world. It seems like I think everyone's going to have a story here, and we would encourage people to tell stories. This has been very, very painful. We've had trauma with people getting killed many years ago here in North Carolina around this time of year, around graduation, where someone shot and killed with an assault-type weapon. We know that. We've experienced it, and there's no community that's immune from this. I think North Carolina's had a lot of these incidents over time. So I just want to acknowledge that and know that there's a lot of healing that needs to occur. And maybe the middle ground that we talked about in today's show is the healing part that needs to occur that everyone should be able to agree on.
Well, and it's something that does cause so much pain and suffering to so many people, and that people are so passionate about for one reason or another, it's hard to see that middle ground. But I hope that this conversation allows us to at least listen and consider other perspectives and think about trying to find that place where we can all work together for a way that decreases violence.
I believe in that fully, and thank you for those comments as well. Well, we're going to conclude now. We'll hope that you'll be able to follow this conversation, and you can follow us on yourhealthradio.org. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Mike Weiser. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And we will look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care, everybody.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.